This is TWiT.
We have Dr. Leslie Dewan with us. She is the co-founder and CEO of a company. You started it, right?
I did, yeah.
Called Transatomic. Your startup that looks to offer clean, safe, affordable nuclear power. We don't usually think of nuclear power as clean, safe, and affordable, though.
What we want to do ultimately is make the type of nuclear reactor that people could plausibly want to have in their backyards or nuclear reactors that people would want to have in their communities. Reactors that can play nice in a grid that has a lot of solar and wind and storage, and just figure out better ways of making carbon-free electricity.
Countries like Germany are phasing out nuclear.
Yeah.
What is the design? Why would you want to phase in nuclear? In fact, one of our visitors is actually working for a Canadian power company that's building a nuclear power plant. Yeah. Why would you want to use nuclear energy? What are the advantages?
So nuclear is really good at producing very large amounts of baseload carbon-free electricity. So just always on constant carbon-free electricity. Like even in the U.S. right now, it produces just about two-thirds of our emissions-free electricity. And, you know, there's some countries that are phasing out nuclear power. There have been a lot of shutdowns of U.S. reactors over the past few years.
These are older reactors, of course.
Yeah, a lot of the older generation of reactors that are now around 40 years old. Switzerland is phasing it out. Germany is phasing it out as well. But countries like China are starting massive build programs of new types of nuclear reactors, like both building up sort of the conventional, like, older generation light water reactor technology, and also putting in a lot of money into new advanced reactor tech. Like, right now in the U.S., there are 99 operating nuclear power reactors. In China, I think there are around 40, 44 that are operating right now, and then plans for another 40 or 50 in the coming decades.
So would
a large number under construction as well.
Would your plan be to stay in the United States or go to a place like China that's building more quickly?
We want to focus on the U.S. market first. And again, this is still in the multi-decade timescales before we'd be able to bring something like this to fruition. But we see a lot of the market being in the U.S. as this country shuts down its existing coal power plants. We want to have a new type of nuclear technology that can fill that gap within the electric grid in the future. But more broadly, like, so much of the market is in the parts of the world that are developing really rapidly and increasing their electricity needs really rapidly. So in China and India and Brazil are enormous markets for new types of nuclear power.
We've seen horrific pollution in Delhi. We've seen horrific pollution in China because of coal-powered plants. Mm-hmm. So this would be less of an environmental impact. And your plants are safer and cleaner than these 40-year-old plants we're decommissioning, right?
Yeah, that was one of the main things that we were focusing on when we started the company. So my co-founder and I, we both became nuclear engineers because we're environmentalists. And we feel that if you can make a better form of nuclear power, one that addresses the existing issues of safety and waste and proliferation and cost, then you'd be able to do something that's really good for the world and producing large amounts of emissions-free electricity.
Right.
So the particular technology that we're working on, we figured out a way so that it produces less than half of the waste of the existing light water reactors that are the majority of the world's fleet today. And it has some tremendous safety benefits as well.
So when we were talking earlier, you started this company right before you got your PhD, and instead of becoming a physicist, but this is old technology, right? I mean, this is something that has been around but not brought to true fruition. Like you're talking about, you've talked to like 60, 70-year-olds in the lab who came up with some of these ideas.
Exactly, yeah. And that's one of the things that makes me so excited about it. So the genesis of this technology, it came about in the 1950s and 1960s. So they, primarily researchers at the Oak Ridge National Lab in Tennessee, came up with a design for a liquid-fueled reactor. So it used molten salts, actually, as fuel rather than the solid uranium oxide fuel rods of traditional reactors today. And that gives it some fantastic safety benefits. So they built a prototype at Oak Ridge in the 1960s. They operated it for several years. And they showed that this type of reactor effectively couldn't melt down, even in the worst-case scenario accident. It was extremely robust. It didn't even have to have any operators on site in order to safely shut itself down. But when they figured this out, this was in late 1960s, early 1970s, it was before there had been any significant nuclear accidents. This design back then was experimental. It was expected to be fairly expensive. It required highly enriched uranium as fuel. And there effectively was a decision made that said, like, well, we don't need this safer nuclear reactor. The ones that we have are safe enough. And it got put on the back burner effectively for many decades. And it's only fairly recently that a number of companies, including Transatomic, have started pursuing it much more aggressively and figuring out ways to optimize the design.
So are you dealing with a lot of fear? I mean, it sounds like it's just the...
Yeah, I'm scared.
No. Because of the accidents, we just think, oh, no, that's too scary.
Chernobyl, like, Fukushima.
Yeah. Is that what you're trying to work against? Just people's just general fear of something that might not actually be true?
So I think what makes nuclear accidents tricky, I mean, so if you look at the, you know, at the hard numbers, and not to come across as callous, but if you just look at the, you know, the death rates per terawatt hour of power produced for different forms of power generation, coal is by far the most deadly because of coal mining collapses, and even not taking into account respiratory illnesses that are caused by coal power pollution. And then right after coal, you have deaths from oil power production, natural gas production, even with solar and wind. Like, I'm a very strong supporter of solar and wind, but you still get deaths, for example, from rooftop solar. Like, I guess per terawatt of energy produced, you have about like 0.1 or so deaths.
People falling off the roof and installing them?
Exactly, yeah.
Holy
and then
cow.
Similarly with wind turbines.
Right.
And then nuclear is an order of magnitude safer than that. And so you can look at those numbers and say, like, oh, well, of course nuclear is safe. But with a nuclear accident, if there's an accident at one plant, it affects a broader area. And that, I think, really changes the perception of what it means for a nuclear accident.
Some
to
of it's
occur,
just techno panic, though, because of the scary atomic. I guess the other issue is waste, and nuclear waste is poisonous for tens of thousands of years, right? How do you handle the waste issue?
The nuclear waste issue, I think, is one of the biggest hurdles that nuclear power has to overcome. And so with our technology, we're able to greatly reduce the amount of waste that's being produced. So we have less than half of the long-lived waste as compared to a conventional reactor. But there's still a lot of research needed to figure out how you can best store that over long periods of time. And there's, you know, some progress in the U.S. side with the Yucca Mountain facility and the waste isolation pilot plant as well. But I think we can look towards other best practices examples of waste facilities in Scandinavia in particular. There's some good ways of storing it. There's a deep borehole technology where you can drill many kilometers into the ground to isolate the waste that way. So it's a solvable problem, and I think that it just needs more more attention being paid to it, or just more, like, more engineers and more technical eyes on it.
Instead of just saying, no, we can't do that, it's too dangerous, and just walking away. It makes sense to have this in your arsenal of power alternatives to coal, to natural gas. But ultimately, do you see renewables as the long-term future, or is this just a stopgap nuclear power, or do you think this will be hand-in-hand with renewables?
I think that there's a lot of room for nuclear to go hand-in-hand with renewables. Like, when I think about the electric grid of the future, I think you want to have a lot of solar, a lot of wind. You need very good forms of storage so you can level out what the curves look like.
Batteries or some other means, yeah.
Exactly, yeah, or pumped hydro storage or something along those lines for grid scale. And I think that there's room for advanced nuclear technologies to be part of the mix. Because, I mean, really, in the years following Three Mile Island and following Chernobyl and even to some degree following Fukushima, there was a quelling, a dying down of research into advanced nuclear reactors. So it's kind of only now that there's a large number of... So you can think about it these ways. So if you look at a graph of the ages of nuclear engineers, it's this really, really bifurcated curve that you can see. So you have a lot of nuclear engineers who are in their 70s or 80s who are, you know, retiring towards the end of their careers. Yes,
yeah.
Who,
yeah,
like, originated this field, who were there from the very, very beginning when you first started having nuclear power. And then there's a gap in the middle with hardly anyone. And then it starts to pick up again. And
it's your generation.
Yeah, right? So you're
studying at MIT. What are you studying? as a PhD student? You're studying nuclear physics?
When I was at MIT, I did my undergrad in nuclear engineering and mechanical engineering.
And did you just run into this? At first, you probably had the same reaction we do. Oh, nuclear power, it's over. When did your mind flip on that? How did that happen?
I think a lot of it would be when I came back to grad school. I started talking a lot with my co-founder, and we were actually in some of the libraries reading a lot of old documents. It was when we were studying for our qualifying exams, and we would take like brief breaks from studying for quals, reading nuclear docs in the library, and because that way we could take a break without feeling guilty.
And, still learning. Right. I'm still reading.
Yeah. And we were so struck by the difference in tone in this older set of documents. Like, you'd look at reports from the 50s and 60s, and there was optimism. Like, they were talking about nuclear-powered cars, nuclear-powered airplanes. Like, they had just built nuclear-powered submarines. And it was this sense of, like, blue-sky thinking. Like, oh, we'll make, you know, reactors cooled by liquid mercury. Right. We'll make liquid-fueled reactors.
Or Mr. Fusion, as in Back to the Future, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And there was this sense of, like, we want to be like that. We want to try new things and do new things. And the nice thing about the position that we're in now, and that all of this sort of new generation of nuclear engineers is in now, is that we can take a lot of advances from other fields. We can take the past 50 years of advances in material science. We can take all of the computer codes that exist now that they didn't have in the 50s and 60s and use it to optimize the design and make it better. So it's like a really, really rich space be working in.
You've got containment vessels that are atmospheric pressure instead of high pressures. You have to have a big dome. You have, and we saw some of these pictures of these new designs. Mm-hmm. They really look amazing. The salt instead of the enriched fuel rods, which eliminate, you don't have to have external power to keep it cool. That was a problem at Fukushima, right? They were going to get a runaway because they had lost power, right?
Exactly, yeah. In a lot of the conventional reactors, you need a constant supply of external electric power.
To keep it cool.
Exactly, so you can keep pumping water over the fuel or else it heats up too much and has a meltdown. But with the liquid-fueled reactors, you don't need that. It has totally different cooling requirements.
So where are you now? First of all, one thing I think is interesting, this is open, right? You're not keeping this a secret. You're not doing this in private. You're open publishing your results.
Yeah, we've been moving to open publish as much of our work as possible. So we have a few technical white papers out on our website. And then also, if you go to the website osti.gov, you can see some of the reports that we've worked on in conjunction with the Oak Ridge National Lab that goes into a lot of detail of the 2D and 3D simulations of the core as well.
This
if you search transatomic January 2017 or maybe December 2016 was the first paper, and then the most recent one was September of this year.
Now, right now, this is funded by grants from the Department of Energy and other places, right?
We have some grants that have come in from DOE, and we're also funded by private venture capital.
Oh,
so
you have investors as well.
Yeah, Peter Thiel's Founders Fund is one of our main investors.
How interesting. And what is the time frame for this? I mean, right now you're designing, thinking about it. Where do you stand now, and how far before we start building these?
So it's long time scales here. So we right now are focusing on design for a smaller scale prototype facility, sort of validating and refining that design.
Okay.
Well, actually, that's kind of step one. We're also closing out step zero here, basically, if we want to index it that way. So we're doing some lab scale tests, a set of that we're just finishing up now, looking at corrosion, because with these liquid fuels, the molten salt fuels, you care
really
a lot
corrosive.
About making sure exactly
yeah. Yeah.
they're corrosive, they're also at around 650 degrees Celsius, and they're radioactive at the same time.
Hooray!
So yeah, my background is in nuclear materials engineering, and so it's an interesting problem.
I bet it's an interesting problem.
So when you're trying to get funding, I mean, is it you're in Silicon Valley where they're like, you need to have, you know, a million followers by next year, like, I mean, is it difficult to convince them of these long-term investments are worthwhile?
It was really interesting for us when we started doing fundraising for this a few years back, because I didn't at the time have much of an entrepreneurial background, and I would talk to some companies and they would be really enthusiastic about the technology, but they'd say, like, oh, this is great, we'll fund you, like, can you have one in 6 months? And so, no, like, it's going to take 10 years, it's going to take 15 years, literally, to make this happen. And we realized, like, at the time, there were hardly any other nuclear startups, so there weren't very many other, like, sorts of existence proofs that we could look at. Mm-hmm. And we said, okay, well, we want to look at what aerospace startups are doing, mm-hmm. because that's kind of similar long timelines, larger dollar amounts, like, big technology pieces. You know, Founders Fund was one of the early investors in SpaceX, and we talked to them. They actually, on their website at the time, they had a picture of the nuclear-powered airplane on their site, and we kind of knew from that, that there might be some good connections there.
Well, you're not alone now. There's over 100 startups in this field.
Yeah, now worldwide, over 100 advanced nuclear startups.
So cool.
Collectively, I think we've collectively, there's been about $1.6 billion in private capital that have gone into
sense that this is real, this could be a big thing, and it's something that we should investigate for our energy future, along with these other technologies.
Yeah. It's not bad if Silicon Valley slowed down a little bit. It's nice. I mean, the move fast and break things ethos.
Don't break this thing. Keep this
maybe,
thing intact.
Yeah, maybe we
so when am I going to have a nuclear reactor in my backyard? That's what I want.
Six months.
Or a car or a plane.
So
we have been submarines. It's not that strange.
Inside
right?
the iPhone?
Yeah.
Or in the iPhone.
If we could make one as small as that would be amazing.
Sure you could.
So we want to break ground on the prototype facility in the early 20s, early next decade.
Early and then, 2020s.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So it's going to be a long time horizon. Yeah. And then you have to build that, operate that for a number of years to collect the data, all the while interfacing with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to show them that it is working the way that you expect it to work. And only following that, would we be able to build the full-scale facility?
This is appropriate.
520 megawatts.
This is appropriate.
Yeah.
You want to do this cautiously, but you have to take the first steps now, or it won't be ready in the 2020s or the 2030s or the 2040s. We need to begin now. I think that's great. So congratulations. Well done. You're going to be doing. Are you comfortable doing this for the rest of your life? Because that's what it sounds like.
Oh yeah. I mean it's. It's just about the most fascinating field to be in because it's interesting physics, it's interesting engineering, it's neat from a regulatory standpoint too. There's a lot of cool pieces that come into
involved.
It.
Gears involved, yeah. And then you have to raise money, and Peter's pretty comfortable with the 2020 time frame. He's not freaking out.
They're good with the timeline.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
So nice to meet you, Dr. Leslie DeWan. She is the co-founder and CEO of Transatomic. What's the website if people want to go?
Transatomicpower.com is the website.
And is there stuff there that a dummy like me could read and learn from?
Yes. In fact, I read it. All.
Oh, good. Yeah. Really neat. I think really exciting. It's so nice to have you back. Thank you for coming by.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me here.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
I want one in my backyard. Or a car would be okay. Submarine? Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, they're building
Ford
nuclear.
Fusion,
which the Ford was, Fusion yeah. literally has Mr. Fusion.
Right.
These are all fission reactors, obviously.
Yeah, these are fission reactors. Sorry. There was, the Ford Nucleon, rather. Sorry. Was their.
Imaginary concept.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They
but
built
there
a little
are
nuclear, model of it.
Their nuclear submarines have little mini nuclear power plants in them, right?
Yep.
Is that the old school technology?
So they're. Most similar to the old school technology. Yeah. I mean, the U.S. got nuclear powered submarines up and running
soon,
first.
Quick,
and then
right.
it's actually like, is there another minute or so for
yeah,
kinetic to.
Yeah, oh, I'm
fantastic. Awesome. Okay.
We're waiting until the 2020s.
We got lots of time.
So the first nuclear powered submarine was the USS Nautilus. That, I guess, was commissioned in 1954, I believe. Okay. And then. Immediately after that, the U.S. wanted to get commercial nuclear power up and running as quickly as possible. And as a point of national pride, the goal was we're going to get this running before the USSR does.
Right.
And so the nuclear-powered submarines, they're perfect, beautiful machines. The reactors in them are optimized for use in a submarine. And so to get commercial power up and running on land, the U.S. effectively took this submarine reactor... put it on land instead of spending another decade or two optimizing a land-based reactor.
Yeah.
And it, you know, it works. It works well. They're great for, you know,
so you mean the power plants we see today are based on nuclear power plants from submarines?
They evolved out of the submarine reactors. They were developed first for the submarines.
Of course, they had ample seawater to cool it with.
Exactly.
Worst case scenario
accident in a submarine, you're not going to run out of water. But one of the reasons, to some degree, why the conventional nuclear reactors that are built today are so expensive is that you need... you need all of these backup safety systems.
Right.
You need all of the facilities to ensure that you have the right
because
amount of water
Because of fuel rods, because of a high pressure and all of the different technologies that these nuclear submarines used, we can do it better.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's what a lot of the advanced reactor companies like Transatomic are doing. Say, all right, we're just going to go back to a much earlier part of the technology tree and see if we can suss out
something
else.
So the submarines actually are part of the conversation. That's very interesting. Yeah.